This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. And today we are positively buzzing. And I said, yes, I mean that literally about National Geographic's upcoming season. It's called Unbelievable, the newest chapter in their landmark series, Secrets of the Bees. And it's exactly what it sounds like, a jaw-dropping, deep-dive look inside the extraordinary life of bees, the architecture of their hives, the complexity of their communications, and why, without them, our ecosystems as we know them would simply collapse.
To help us break it all down, we're joined today by one of the show's foremost experts on the planet when it comes to these remarkable insects. He's a researcher, a communicator, and a very passionate advocate for the science of small things with enormous impact. It's Dr. Samuel Ramsey, better known as Dr. Sammy. He's a leading entomologist and a scientist who has dedicated his career to understanding the creatures that quietly hold our food supply together. Dr. Sammy, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks for being with us. It is a very big thing and a tall order to say that the little creature, the bee, quietly holds our food supply together. You didn't make that up either.
Oh, I definitely didn't make that up. This is simply the science. There are four, let's see, there's four aspects of the livestock globally that really hold together our food systems. So there are cows, pigs, chickens, and bees. Bees are actually the third most valuable livestock on the planet. They contribute about $18.7 billion to the United States economy, primarily by flying from one plant to another, carrying little grains of pollen, and making sure that those plants produce fruits and vegetables and spices and nuts that we consume on a regular basis.
Well, okay, so without these pollinators, the bees, what would happen to our vegetation?
It wouldn't be pretty. There are a lot of plants out here that are heavily dependent on bees. The vast majority of them would not set fruit without pollination from these bees. And while there are a lot of other pollinators out there are a lot of beetles and bats and butterflies and other things here, the bees are the ones that have really gone all in. Pollinating is their whole shebang. They are covered in all of these branching hairs all over their bodies so that they can easily transport huge volumes of pollen from one place to the next. They're the best at it.
So we're going to go back in time a little bit and figure out how this actually all started, your fascination with bees, because a little bee told me, just like the rest of us, when we're young, we avoid bees. We're afraid of bees. We're terrified of bees. So what was your aha moment when you decided this is going to be your life's calling?
Oh, my goodness. So I've been obsessed with insects since I was a little kid. I'll tell you guys, I was an odd little guy. I told my parents when I was 7 years old, quote, I want to be an entomologist when I grow up. And there was this scary point where I had to figure out, in the more than a billion species of insects on this planet, which one do I want to dedicate my time, effort, energy to studying consistently? And that's a tall order when you love all the bugs. I'm an equal opportunity entomologist, y'all. Like, I love the insects. But when I really took a deep look at not just what the bees do, but the intelligence embedded in how they do it, and also the need there, the fact that they truly need a diverse assemblage of researchers doing everything that we can to keep them healthy. That was when I decided, you know what? These are the insects that truly need my attention.
And evidently they have it big time, because when National Geographic came to you about Unbelievable, I just love that title, I could say it all day, as the newest chapter in the Secret of the Bee series, what was your reaction? What made you decide that, well, this is really the right moment to tell this story?
I think what's actually a really important aspect of the story to tell is that there is no one secret to the bees. So it's actually plural, secrets of the bees. And there are quite a few. The bees themselves are absolutely laden with them. There are so many fascinating things that the bees are doing behind the scenes that we don't really pay a lot of attention to. And something that I've recognized as a scientist, so the same year that they asked me to be a part of Secrets of the Bees, it was my first year as a professor, and I was so excited by all of the incredible equipment that we have here at the university, all of the amazing microscopes, and because of this equipment, I'm able to see the bees from a vantage point that pretty much no one else can. When we started working on this project, Secrets of the Bees, the exciting thing was that I would finally be able to show people the bees in ways that they've never seen them before. So many of the exciting things that I've been able to see that the bees have kind of withheld as their own specific secrets, we're going to reveal those in this documentary. And man, is it an exciting prospect for me to think about how you guys are going to feel when you see all of this.
Okay, so the series is National Geographic Secret of the Bees, but this Unbelievable is a chapter in the Secrets of the Bees. I'm thinking that it's titled this way because there are these really surprising things that we have no idea of. For people who think that they already really understand the bees, what is the biggest sort of misconception or thing that you think that they don't know?
I think the biggest misconception about bees is that they are these surly, angry creatures that are looking for a way to just sting somebody today. And if more people recognized that bees don't survive the process of defending themselves, I think they'd also recognize that they don't want to get into a confrontation with anyone under any set of circumstances. They only do so when they have to or when they're really, really confused. I think that would help people a lot when they're in these circumstances that happen pretty frequently. They're outside, minding their own business, and a bee just shows up and starts buzzing around them. And they think that bee is being aggressive. And what they often don't recognize is they actually sprayed their hair with plant oils in the morning. They washed their hair with shampoos that have plant oils in them. They wore a floral dress. You smell and look like their food source, and you have confused them. And then when they come over to smell and see like, oh, is this some nectar? You try to swat them. It's rude. Personally, I feel like the bait and switch is something that we personally should be upset with ourselves over rather than getting mad at the bees.
That is such a great point. I've never thought of that before. Yeah, this mistaken, it has mistaken me for something it thinks it should pollinate. I love that. Makes us sound a little sweeter than we probably are.
Exactly.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're talking to Dr. Samuel Ramsey, Dr. Sammy. And when you mentioned the university, you're at University of Colorado, is that right? Boulder?
Correct.
So you're just down the road from us, sort of. So aren't those students lucky to have an entomologist like you teaching them and really turning them on to these wonderful little entities that hold our world together? Yeah.
I think of myself as lucky that I've been so excited about entomology for such a long time. If I didn't have this outlet to constantly yammer on and on and on about bees, I don't know what I would do.
That's wonderful. Okay, help me then. We're scared of wasps more so than bees. What's the difference between a bee and a wasp? And do we have reason to want to rid ourselves of wasps, or do they also perform some wonderful task?
Good questions. So there is, I think, an unsettling dichotomy that I've been seeing with people where they will take the context of bees and they'll say, oh, you guys have had it all wrong all this time. The bees are actually gentle and nice and lovely. The wasps are murderous and evil, and those are the ones you should be afraid of. And really, at the end of the day, the bees and the wasps have no intent to harm anyone. They don't wake up in the morning thinking, all right, I'm going to sharpen my stinger and I want to figure out whose picnic I can ruin today. Like, it's just not a part of their plans for the day. And under every set of circumstances, when they are trying to defend things, like the goal is defense and not aggression. They do not eat humans. We are not a part of their diet. They are not going after us. And so it's the circumstances where you drive a lawnmower over their house where they get pretty surly, and you'll find yellow jackets coming out of the ground and going after you. Now, I know that that's cold comfort for anyone who has had the experience of driving a riding lawnmower over a wasp nest that they didn't know was there. I apologize on behalf of the bugs to everyone for whom that is an experience of yours. But I will say that it is not their desire to just terrorize people. And when we give them names like murder hornets and so on, it can kind of leave people with that impression. Now, the difference between them, and I think that's a really good question to ask, the difference is both in where they live and in how they look. So while that black and yellow coloration, which is called an aposematic coloration is a set of colors that tells an organism at a distance, don't play with me. If you mess with me, you're going to find out. So you don't want to mess around. Well, under that set of circumstances, we have noticed that black and yellow, black and orange, and black and red are a combination of colors that insects use to send a signal. You'll see it in fireflies because they are chemically defended. You should not eat a firefly. Ladybugs, don't eat ladybugs. They are full of isopropyl methoxypyrazine, not good for your digestive system. But bees and wasps are different. They're not poisonous. They're venomous. They can sting. Well, the difference that you'll see with them is really that the bees are a lot fuzzier. There's a lot of fur on them. They are the fluffy puppy individuals of the flying insect world. And then there are the wasps, which are much more bald, a lot less hair on them. And they tend to have a harder look to them. Their bodies look more armored, as they often are. They also live in different places. Honeybees are cavity nesting species. They live inside of a hole, at least the honeybees that we have here, and they build out wax comb. But wasps actually build those football-shaped, weird, papery doohickeys that hang from trees or are inside of a hole in the ground. And that is how you know that you've got a wasp. If you see that hanging from a tree, you've probably got bald-faced hornets, a type of wasp, or European hornets, another type of wasp. And it's their capacity to sting multiple times that makes them really scary, because honeybees can only sting once, but a hornet can jam that stinger in, pull it out, sting again as pretty much as many times at once, which is unpleasant.
So you actually said fluffy puppy of the insect shield.
I did say that. Okay. And I stand by that. I stand by that assessment.
In researching this for this interview, I see that you actually describe the bees as a superorganism, the colonies functioning almost as a single living entity, which I think is going to be really cool to find out more about that, obviously, as we see the series. But how do you explain that concept to someone hearing it for the first time, and why does it matter?
The concept of a superorganism is one that I think matters quite consistently to us as human beings, because we, in a lot of ways, function that way. We are an assemblage of cells that all have different functions. They assort into tissues, and they do really cool things. And without this assemblage, we really wouldn't be able to accomplish a lot of what we accomplish. The honeybees themselves are a lot like us. So the bees form this tight-knit group that is able to execute really complicated tasks because of the specialization between the different individuals in the colony. And all together, they function as a single organism composed of many. So while there are a bunch of bees that are flying around that are guarding the colony, functioning as something like an immune system, there are bees inside the colony that are moving food around, functioning like a digestive system. There are bees inside of the colony that are building out the wax, and they function a lot like the skin inside of our bodies. And so that whole assemblage of creatures, if they didn't all pursue their jobs the way that they need to, things would break down and the whole organism would suffer. They are a super organism because they are comprised of all of these different individuals doing incredible things.
So when we're talking about these bees with these different functions, and you're describing them as like maybe different parts of the body, the communication that happens inside the hive is extraordinary in itself. It's almost like the nervous system. I mean, they've got the waggle dance, they've got the pheromone signaling, even vibrations. Mm-hmm. Did the filming of the unbelievable reveal anything special about bee communication that maybe surprised even you as an expert?
I love seeing bees communicate with each other. There's so much back and forth between them, so much interaction. But when some of what we saw, especially when I was in London actually filming this segment where we're looking at the intelligence of bees and we're working with bumblebees, the actual communication that's involved in teaching each other is something that I did not expect to see. Now, I knew that they could do this higher order thinking where they think through, in order to do this, in order to get to my goal, I have to move this. And until I move this, I can't move the second thing that allows me to get to the reward that is my food. Like, I knew that they were capable of that. I've read about that. I've seen that myself. What I hadn't seen Was a bee teach another bee to do this? The complex communication necessary for one individual to teach another individual to do something is oftentimes something that we tend to think of for the larger organisms, the bigger brain creatures, the primates, maybe the elephants or something. But this context with an insect whose brain is a fraction the size of a grain of rice, it is remarkable to see it not just solve a puzzle, but then to actually teach an individual behind it how to do the same.
That's fascinating. Okay, I'm just wondering, Dr. Sammy, if you, after having spending so much time researching the bees and looking at them, studying their mode of communication, have you, it's almost like, you know, studying the hieroglyphics on wall of an Egyptian, you know, like, have you started to know what they're saying to each other?
You know, I cannot take credit in such a way where I can say that I've deciphered what the bees are saying in these different contexts. Other researchers have really focused on communication in bees, and through the constant building of information from one researcher building on the work of another researcher, we have learned quite a bit. And one of the, there's so many ways that they communicate. One that I find absolutely just enchanting is the fact that inside of the colony, where it is totally dark, the bees have to have a way of letting other bees know, I'm coming around a corner, I'm carrying something, I don't want to drop it, I hope nobody is in the way. In the same way that we have those trucks that automatically make that beep, beep, beep noise when they're backing up, the bees do that. They'll walk through the colony, and if they're going around a corner and they might actually bump into somebody, they'll go toot, 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 toot. And it's just, it's kind of amazing. And that's not something that I can say that I was able to discover. There are other researchers who have, but it's work that all together, because of the way that the scientific apparatus fits together, we are all benefiting from that set of knowledge. And it's knowledge that we use consistently in my lab to better understand what's going on in our observation hive.
Wow, that's incredible. Okay, considering that you live in the neighboring state, Colorado, you must know what the Utah state, that we are the beehive state, right?
Oh, I do know that. Mm-hmm.
Are you a little bit envious?
Just a little bit. My partner's from Utah, and he has never let me forget that it is indeed the beehive state.
So this is presumably because we operate like a colony or community here in Utah. But that said, also among the bee population, and probably here in Utah, we have people who, they don't sign on to this beehive notion. They're solo players. And that was really interesting to find out about bees, is that they're not all, you know, part of the big collective. So
true.
What about the, you know, the guys who want to go solo?
Oh my goodness. This is also something that when we first started talking about how we were going to craft this documentary, it was really, really, really important for me to know that it wasn't just going to be about honeybees. I love honeybees. I spend a lot of my attention working with honeybees, but there are 20,000 species of bees. And I want people to know that the honeybees are the exception to the rule. They are the most successful of all of the bee species because of the fact that they live together in this colony system, because they are actually raising children together communally. So they discovered universal childcare before we did, which is quite impressive. But what they have is actually really quite remarkable. But the vast majority of the bees, they live in a more difficult set of circumstances. The vast majority of bees are actually single mothers. They live in a hole in the ground, and they are raising their own offspring by themselves without any help from anyone else. And it's a really difficult context, and they make it work. And all of the brilliant, intricate ways that they make it work are worth us looking into and better understanding, because they reveal a lot to us about the difficulties that exist in the world, the challenges biologically, and how creatures have figured out how to overcome them. So one of the things that I was the most excited about in this documentary were the ways that we used different sets of really small cameras to actually get into those holes. And you'll notice in the documentary, we consistently flash back and forth between video shots where you can see the bee itself doing what it's doing, and then a shot that's from the bee's perspective so that you can imagine yourself in that context. Because what I really wanted to see from this documentary was that it would embed a sense of interspecies empathy within people. This can capacity to imagine yourself outside of the context that you constantly exist in, but to recognize that the world is seen totally differently by other creatures, and that there's a lot to gain from understanding how they process the world.
I'm fascinated by the technology used to kind of get a bee's eye view, for lack of a better word, and how much, by the way, I think it's kind of important to note that this series, and particularly your segment, has a little something to do with some pretty famous movies. I mean, we brought Avatar in there. Tell me about the connection.
So I love that you do a little name drop in there. I have been talking to so many different individuals about this documentary. I've noticed that there's a generational divide. When I say that the director for this documentary was the James Cameron, I have students who say, oh, wow, the Avatar guy? And then I have individuals older than me who will say, oh, the Titanic guy. My goodness. So it really is a divide based on your age as to what you'll know that for. But the fact that James Cameron was a part of this project, and it was one of the first things that they told me about. And they're like, yeah, the Secrets of the Bees docuseries that's been going for a few years now, James Cameron is the director, and his capacity to show the world from these different angles and vantage points is really quite remarkable. And I was sold.
I think it's great. And I love that you've got him on board as well as your cinematographer, which is also pretty amazing that you've got these incredible shots. I want to go back to the honeybee, though, for a moment, because I know that we've been talking about, and please correct me if I've got this wrong, but is it called hive collapse, where we are losing honeybees at a fairly alarming rate? And do we draw attention to that in this series?
Yes, we do, and we have to. There's pretty much no way to talk about the honeybees or to talk about bees generally without talking about the plight of the bees. The fact that this system of colony collapse, where colonies will seemingly be doing okay, and then something will trigger this substantial abandonment of the colony itself, where just a few individuals are present along with the queen. That was a really disturbing set of circumstances that emerged about 20 years ago, and we still have not figured out exactly what caused it. We think that there is some connection to the parasitic mites inside of the colony, because the vast majority of colonies presenting with this set of symptoms had these mites in them. But what is actually more disturbing is that we haven't seen colony collapse disorder in its purest form. We haven't really seen colony collapse disorder in more than 10 years. But we are seeing losses in excess of the ones that we saw at that time. So colony collapse disorder was not the only problem for our bees. It was not the biggest problem for our bees. It seems more like it was the exclamation point at the end of a very long and very concerning sentence about the health of the bees. And the fact that these honeybees, I want people to know that honeybees are actually an introduced species. They are incredible organisms. They do amazing things, and we can learn so much from them. But we also need to be very well aware that there are 4,000 other species of bees in North America, and these honeybees are the canary in the coal mine that provide us with a lot of information about what the rest of these bees are going through, and us paying attention to them and figuring out how to keep them healthy and how to, in that way, also keep the rest of the bee populace healthy is really, really critical. But we have to pay close attention and really understand what's happening here.
Well, as a final question, Dr. Sammy, your work is sort of focuses on the education of people and hopefully getting us to sign on to the importance of supporting the bees. And what can we do that will support the bees and kind of fight back against hive collapse?
I love when we end with this question, because I want the freshest thought in people's minds when they are done listening to me today to be, there is something that I can do. All of us are capable of helping this situation, because the bees need many of the same things that we need ourselves. If you think of Maslow's hierarchy, this is Maslow's hierarchy of bees. For this, consider that they need food and shelter just as much as we do. And a lot of the food sources that would be available to them, we have gotten rid of. Our lawns are just these pristine green wastelands that don't have any food available to them. And instead of having these bright green lawns that are just grass, if we could plant flowers, we would do so much to help our bee population. That if you plant just 1 square foot of flowers, you can feed hundreds of pollinators and you can also house them. And many of those pollinators will literally live at the base of the plants that they are interested in feeding, because obviously it's really nice to live next to your local grocer. And so digging those holes in the ground or even living in the stems of these plants is really helpful for them. You could also rewild your entire lawn, and that way you don't have to mow the lawn. Isn't that amazing? And then in addition, you can stop raking the leaves, because those leaves provide a boundary layer such that the bees will be better able to overwinter and not freeze. It'll really keep them warm and happy during the winter. So just leave those leaves there.
Oh, that's great. That's great justification that I needed to leave them there. I usually do anyway.
Well, I'm Dr. Sammy, your friendly neighborhood entomologist, and I am here to help.
Dr. Samuel Ramsey has been our guest, and he's talked to us today about the newest chapter called Unbelievable. It's in the landmark series of National Geographic, Secrets of the Bees, and you can see it on Disney Plus.
And I'm really excited for all of you to see the amazing things going on here.
Wonderful. Dr. Sammy, thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you.